Hey everyone.
Bonjour à tous and welcome to the Adler's Podcast, the podcast where we discuss pressing issues and new discoveries that impact both domestic policy and international diplomacy. Stay tuned for the brand new episode that we have in store for you today. This podcast was recorded from Radio Monash and is brought to you by the Monash International Affairs Society, or MICE for short. Don't forget to follow Atlas on Spotify for updates on newly released podcasts. And remember to check the MICE accounts on Facebook and Instagram to stay updated. Now, without further ado, onto the episode.
Climate change has become a more prevalent issue than ever before. Temperatures have been progressively rising, and the consequences have so far been showing, with each year getting worse and worse. The annual 2022 Global Climate Report from the National Centres for Environmental Information reported that the rate of global warming has even doubled since 1981, and it's only getting worse. Samantha Burgess, the Deputy Director of the Copernicus Climate Change Service, stated in July that, open quote, 2023 is currently the third warmest year to date at 0.4 degrees Celsius above the recent average, with the average global temperature in July at 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. These records have dire consequences for both people and the planet exposed to ever more frequent and intense extreme events. Close quote. Now, there may have been some that are still skeptical about the impact that this rise in temperature has on the environment, but we must only look at the past to feel the gravity of the situation. In 2020, we faced more than 10 million hectares decimated, 28 people killed, and thousands of families displaced. Something needs to change. Organizations like the World Wildlife Fund and the UN are trying to push for stronger environmental sustainability, with the Wildlife Fund pushing towards the conservation and saving of ecosystems, and the UN pushing towards policies that support climate action, such as net zero. However, there is an extra party that does play a role in policymaking and global initiatives. Although rising information regarding the influence of corporations has become ever more prevalent, have there been ways in which companies have progressed towards environmental sustainability, despite what the public opinion may actually be? And why? First, I'll be discussing the ways companies, especially mining companies, have pushed for environmental sustainability with Rebecca Arendal. Rebecca is a consultant from KPMG. She'll provide us with her experiences working with the mining industries and the ways in which she has seen them progress toward environmental sustainability. Is there enough being done? Is the amount they're doing surprisingly more than what the public may expect? That'll be up for you to decide. Now, without further ado, on to the interview. Hi, Beck. Thank you for joining me on the interview today.
Thank you so much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So, Beck, for the first question, what has your job been as a consultant focused on climate change and sustainability? What have been some of the companies you've worked with? What policies and projects have you been involved in when it comes to environmental sustainability?
Yeah, thank you. They're a really great question. Before I jump in, I should just do a little disclaimer just to say that everything that I'm sharing today is, of course, my opinion and not reflective of any of the organisations I've worked for or with. So now that that's out of the way. So I work at KPMG as a climate change and sustainability consultant. I know the word consultant's a little bit like, what's that? I did see a TikTok once that was like, what does a consultant do? A consultant does consultation to consult, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, yeah, that's about right. But being a consultant, basically, we do work for different clients. Clients come to us and ask for a range of different services, whether it's advisory, which is more, as the name suggests, giving advice. You know, it might be, can you write us an ESG strategy? Can you prepare us a climate change report? Can you do research for us into this issue? That kind of work. And then we also do assurance work, which is doing basically auditing an organization's sustainability disclosures, whether that's in an annual report, a sustainability report, or a separate piece of reporting or requirement that a company does. As a consultant, I work on a range of these different projects and work for a range of different clients in different settings and with a range of different pieces of work. So some of the clients that I've had the fortune of working with include the Carbon Market Institute of Australia, looking into carbon farming. I've also done work for the federal government and different different state and territories governments. I've also done work for some of the big miners, including Rio Tinto, BHP, Fortescue Metals Group, and a few other smaller places as well, which has been quite interesting. Some of the projects that I've worked on has been a range of different pieces of work for those clients. In particular, I have done a secondment with BHP twice now, helping them with their sustainability reporting, which has been quite an interesting experience. And then I've also done assurance for Rio Tinto, so on the flip side, and obviously a competitor. So it was quite interesting to sort of see the two different takes on that as well.
Before going to the second question, I just might want to jump in there. In terms, you said you had a really interesting experience with BHP. Could we expand more into that? If you're allowed to, that's okay.
No, that's totally fine. I think it was just eye-opening for me because I can remember explicitly about 2 years ago thinking that all miners were terrible and that mining is, I did my Master of Environment and Sustainability at Monash, and a lot of the thinking for me personally was about how we shouldn't be digging up new, we should be recycling, repurposing, using what we've already got, and obviously mining has a huge environmental impact. And I have this vivid recollection of watching the Australian Open, and there was this ad and it was all this mining and it was saying we're mining for the future, and I was thinking, oh, this is a load of crap, like whatever, and it was BHP. And now I think back and I go, oh, actually, my perspective has really changed on this, because having been inside the organization and seeing that there's this huge team of individuals who are working towards actually having a positive impact, and recognizing that we, whilst there are obviously a multitude of terrible things that have happened in the past and probably will still be some in the future, we acknowledge that there's actually a lot of positive work being done in this space too. And there are people within BHP and within Rio Tinto and with other miners who really actually care about the environment and what they're doing. But also I realized that if we don't have miners, particularly on issues of commodities like nickel and steel, aluminium, cobalt, lithium, we don't have the transition. We don't have solar panels, we don't have wind turbines, we don't have electric cars. And there's just not enough in the world at the moment to create into these things. So we do need to actually mine. And that really made me realize, okay, maybe they're not as terrible as I thought. That and also I think the pure social investment that particularly the big miners put into the communities, and particularly Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities that otherwise wouldn't have access to healthcare or employment or jobs in their communities, and that the miners actually put so much money into these communities in Australia and in their overseas operations, and they give back a lot to the community as well and are quite conscious of what they call social license to operate in those communities. So obviously there's still bad things that go on, and the Yukon Gorge destruction was obviously a major issue, and quite a while ago in Brazil, the Samarco Dam failure, which BHP and another miner, Vale, were involved in, had huge impacts, and it's obviously devastating, and I know there'll be issues with others in the future. But to know that generally all these issues that are being avoided and all the proactive work that is being done made me feel a little bit less angry, I guess you could say, towards mining. Yeah.
Going off from one of your responses, in terms of this idea that we require the mining industry, such as BHP, to be able to produce these metals, such as lithium, to be able to produce solar panels, for how long do you think we're going to be dependent on these mining industries? Do you think that they're going to be around for as long as solar panels will be around? Do you think we'll find another way of being able to extract lithium without the mining methods that we have today? Or do you think that the impact that the mining industry has is minimized due to this requirement for lithium and for other metals that are required for our sustainable energy sources?
That's a really great question. I don't think the need for these minerals negates the impact that miners are having. I think they still need to measure all their emissions and their environmental and their social impact associated with this mining, whether we need those commodities or not. In terms of how long, I really don't know. I mean, it's quite up in the air what the transition is going to look like, and what we know we need these commodities, but we don't, if we want to sustain the current standard of living that we have in Australia and America, in Europe, in Asia, everywhere around the world, it's going to take a hell of a lot of these commodities to be able to do that. So it might even be a change of, we need to reconsider how we actually live on a day-to-day basis, as well as back on the miners as well. It's quite complex, and none of us really know what we're in for.
And a lot of the main issues in terms of that as well, especially for Australia, is that we so heavily rely on these mining commodities. Coal is a large statistic when it comes to our income, especially with our trade agreements with outer countries like China. It's a very multi-level concept to comprehend, because we so heavily rely on Australia on these big industries to be able to use as both a fuel source and economic source.
Yeah, I think you make an excellent point in terms of coal. It is, yeah, it's Australia's biggest export, with China being the biggest importer. Yep. So, yeah. Yeah, you have got some miners who are divesting away from coal mining. So BHP is one of those examples that they only mine what they call metallurgical coal, which is at the moment required for steel making. So we need steel, so we have to use, at the moment, we have to use this met coal to create steel. We don't have a green alternative for that at the moment. But obviously you still have your other companies that are still mining coal. And it's been quite interesting because in the news recently, they've been talking about how in Victoria, in Australia, there's a high likelihood of power outages because we are having increasing reliance on electricity, particularly with announcements around all new homes not being allowed to have gas connections. So there's an increased demand for electricity. In the meantime, we're trying to switch off from coal, particularly brown coal-fired power stations, but we just don't have the renewable options to fill that gap at the moment, fill that need. And obviously this issue compounds when you've got hotter weather, people are more likely to use their air conditioning and have it on for longer periods, and there's a bigger demand. So we haven't quite worked out the crux of how we transition away perfectly from coal to renewables. And I think part of it comes down to the individual, because I don't know about you, but I know me personally, I'm going, well, I'm hot, I'd rather have the air conditioning on if it's 45 degrees outside than worry about whether or not there's coal burning to sustain that. So it is quite complex. And I think we as consumers have to also think about some of the decisions we make in turn. And it sounds so small, but things like, you know, not having washing machines running all the time or air conditioning on all the time, it's what can we do to sort of reduce that reliance on electricity until the system can meet the demands for what we need while we're still trying to move away from coal.
With your experience as a climate change and sustainability consultant, what have been some of your experiences working with mining companies? Have you seen progress from these companies towards achieving greater sustainability? Is there a large area for improvement for mining companies when it comes to tackling climate change?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question as well. And I think, look, everyone has a lot of room for improvement. And you've got, there's a whole range of different miners in Australia, from your big ones like your BHP and your Rio Tinto, who've got a lot more backing and financial capital to be able to make changes, all the way down to brand new companies that are just starting up and doing exploration activities that perhaps don't have the money at the moment to be investing into change and sustainability and climate change actions, but we know that we need those materials and those commodities. So I think, yeah, there's always room for improvement. And what that looks like for different companies is different depending on what's going on. But there's a need for the industry to come together and work collaboratively and also work with governments across all the mining states, but nationally, to come up with a plan for how they can work together to address this issue, which is important. My personal experience has been really positive. I think, as I mentioned earlier, that people who are working in these spaces actually truly care about what they're doing. To give you a bit of a picture, and this is true across Rio Tinto and BHP that I've, in my experience, you've got a climate change team of dedicated people who are just working on climate change and emissions and mitigating and risk and adaptation. There's a whole group of people sitting behind that work. But then in terms of sustainability, there's also the Indigenous communities team. There's also a water team, an environment team, a biodiversity team, a nature-based solutions team, a tailings team, and so on and so forth. And that's sort of even just at the sort of global group level. And then you've got all the different assets across the different countries that then also have an environment person, Indigenous person, a water person, so on and so forth. So there's a real army and community of different people working in these organizations to try and make a difference. And I think it's important to recognize that whether or not these people are in these companies, they're still going to be mining. So it's important that we've got people on the inside who really care about what they're doing and try to have a positive impact in the space, or at least be able to try and counteract some of the more negative impacts that are happening.
That's a really good point to bring up. Thanks, Beck. In terms of these roles that have been established in these mining companies, have you seen positive change and progress when it comes to these roles? Because there's a lot of speculation from a lot of the public that may see a lot of these mining companies that use different roles that take on different aspects such as climate change as a sort of scapegoat. Have you seen in your experience that these roles have actually attributed positive change both to Australia and on the international sphere?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think there probably are some organisations that do just have sustainability and climate change roles as a bit of a PR stunt, but at least from what I've seen with clients that I've worked with, definitely not. They've all been involved in positive change and want to drive change. It's also something that they have to be cognizant of is greenwashing risks and legislation and legal issues. So we've seen in the EU that there's a lot more pressure on being transparent and open. with these disclosures. In Australia recently, the ACCC looked into two different superannuation funds who've basically said, you know, they've got a sustainable portfolio that you can invest in, and it turns out deep within there that they, you know, they've got oil or gas, so then they've had a lot of issues and trouble with that. So I think that legal landscape is changing, and that there are a lot of risks with making claims about you're doing something positive. Well, can you actually prove that? Can you actually show us that you're doing it? And I think that's something that particularly the big miners are acutely aware of. There's a team of amazing legal people in these organizations who are across all of these risks and issues and diving into them and making sure that no one's making any claims that aren't correct. And that's also where your consulting firms and assurance firms come in, basically being that third party check to make sure that none of the facts or figures that are being disclosed are either over or understating whether that's positive or negatively contributing to the organization.
Thanks, Beck. Thanks for really clearing that up. So we've talked a lot about your consultancy in Australia and its national interests. Have you had any experience overseas or in terms of international interest when it comes to environmental sustainability?
I haven't done a lot of work in this space, but it's definitely a consideration, particularly when you're working with some of the larger organisations and businesses in Australia that obviously then do have a flow-on effect into these international markets. It is interesting because some of where I guess this does come from is a lot of the voluntary and mandatory reporting standards in the sustainability space. In Australia, we don't actually have any mandatory reporting or disclosure requirements for any company. That is being looked into to change just for the start of financial year 2025. There's currently federal government consultation at the moment. But in the EU, they've got a range of requirements that companies must disclose on certain topics. And if you're a BHP or a Rio Tinto with interest in those areas or operations or assets or people, then you have to sort of meet those. So there's definitely that sort of angle to it that we need to be aware of what is happening in the international space, partly because, yeah, as I mentioned, there's interest there, but also because Australia does tend to look to Europe and see what's happening there to then adjust and change what's happening in their laws and regulations in the landscape. So it's definitely something we're aware of and cognizant of, because particularly in the globalised environment that we live in.
From that last response, I just want to make a quick question or a quick comment. In terms of that inspiration from the European standard of environmental sustainability, do you believe that there's a sort of limitation, there's a sort of barrier when it comes to being able to achieve a mimicry of the European standard? And due to our isolation as a country, as Australia, you think there may be some limitations there in being able to achieve that sustainability when it comes to trading of resources?
Yeah, look, there's definitely some limitations. And of course, every jurisdiction is different. We talked about that earlier in terms of Australia's reliance on coal as an export being a huge financial imperative. But I think it's more, from my perspective, it's more that we can at least look, Europe's pushing us to be better because they at the moment have a better standard of disclosure and requirements. Obviously, there's still some issues that Europe has to work through, the same as Australia has to work through their own issues. But generally speaking, I think if we've got standards and pressure coming from the European setting that's pushing out towards Australian companies, that's going to push them to work better. And then inevitably, if your BHPs and Rio Tintos of the world are meeting these standards in Europe, it's pushing up their credibility in the Australian market, which will hopefully, in theory, drag up some of the smaller and mid-tier miners as well, going, well, hang on a sec, if that's what you've got to do to be competitive, let's also do that. And I hope that that would only have a net overall positive impact. But of course, there's always extenuating circumstances and factors at play. But I genuinely think it's a positive thing.
So Beck, there are a lot of people that have skepticisms of big companies when it comes to their donations to charities and also their lobbying for governments and their influence on the government. An example of this is there are fossil fuel industries that do donate to charities and organizations that focus on environmental sustainability. From this, could you determine that these fossil fuel industries, although not explicitly, are implicitly creating a bias on these companies and charities? Do you feel like charities should reject these donations and therefore not be able to get the funding? Or do you feel like there's a compromise that you can make where you can take in the funding from these outer companies that may be a conflict of interest, but also still fight for the change that you want to fight for?
Yeah, look, it's a really great question and something I think that comes down to the individual charities and partners, because no one's immune to influence. I mean, we all are, no matter where you are or what stage, if you're an individual or a company or where you stand. But on the same stead, you could also make the point that if environmentally focused charity or organization is taking money from a fossil fuel company, well, that's something that might be being that might be something good that's coming out of that as well, or taking money away from a company that you might not necessarily believe in. But I do think it really comes down to the individual charity or organization. Some might be might have a flat rule that they don't want to, and that's totally acceptable. But I don't think that it's necessarily a bad thing if some are choosing to take it. It's what's, I guess, done with that money. If they're then doing it in exchange for making false statements then about that organization, then obviously that, I think that's quite problematic. But if it's being done in a way to that's being the money is then being used for positive change, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. It's just a bit of a trade-off that each individual organization or charity has to make when it comes to that situation.
That's a good point. Thanks, Beck. And my last question: have you seen examples of these big industries that have been holding the people accountable rather than their own companies accountable? An example is BP, how they created the carbon footprint, and that held the people accountable for their own environmental sustainability rather than holding the actual company accountable. Have you seen lots of examples of this type of corporate scapegoat on the public, both on the national level and on the international level?
Yeah, look, BP is a really interesting example because I think it was, 2004 they coined the idea, and they had a public relations person come in and they said, yep, this is how we're going to change your image. And they said, yep, let's create carbon footprint and get the individual to think about what they're doing instead of looking back upon themselves and thinking about what positive change they could make. I think they really missed an opportunity to be like, here's our carbon footprint and what we're doing. What about you? Like, that could have been quite a collaborative moment, but instead was sort of shifting the blame and the obligation back on the individual. I personally haven't seen a lot of it in the work that I've done, but I know that it obviously does happen, and BP is a great example of that. Yeah, you kind of think, well, there's all these issues, and at the end of the day, I think that organizations, businesses, companies do have an obligation to consider the impact that they're having and the environmental and social sustainability issues they're creating. If we look to the pandemic in 2020, global greenhouse gas emissions dropped by about 4.6% globally due to lockdowns, which is quite a low figure, actually, because that was mostly contributed to transport emissions, because obviously people like you and I weren't getting on planes or driving cars. So that sort of suggests that the role of business and big companies is still having a huge impact on the environment. And then when we look to 2021, these emissions immediately spiked to higher than pre-pandemic levels, largely driven by manufacturing, which, makes us sort of go, well, hang on, haven't we learned anything from the beautiful clear canals in Venice or the wildlife coming back into the environments that they previously hadn't been into? So there is definitely a role and a responsibility of businesses not to try and shirk this off to other people, but to work collaboratively with governments and people and the consumers to have an impact. And part of it is consumers and people like you and me choosing where we put our money, because money does talk in this capitalist society that we live in. But it's also, government pressure and organizations realizing that they can't just keep doing business as usual and not consider the impact that they're having.
Absolutely. Well, Beck, do you have any other last comments or questions you want to throw out there before we finish the interview?
Yeah, no, thank you so much for having me. I think the only, I guess, parting thought I would leave with anyone who's listening is just be open to changing your perspective and ideas and listening to different opinions when it comes to different industries, even to the point of there's always these conversations about, we should be shutting down coal-fired power stations. But as soon as it's talked about, the unions and the workers there are suddenly like, no, I'm going to lose my job. We need to keep them. It's just nothing. I don't think anything is inherently terrible. There's always two sides to every story, and just being open to understanding a different perspective on something, I think, is really important, because that was something that I did, and it's really changed my thinking and enabled me to learn a lot more about the complexity of the issues and the transition as we move forward.
Thank you so much for that, Beck. I really enjoyed the interview that we had today. Thank you so much for joining the interview with me.
Thanks so much for having me. Speak soon.
Hey guys, thank you so much for listening in today. I hope you guys really enjoyed that episode. I found it really inspirational to hear so much information and really opening up my eyes and getting such a large experience from this whole topic, because it is such a big topic that is ever so prevalent nowadays, and it is such an important issue that we need to discuss. But it is also a very complicated and multi-layered issue that requires a lot of variables. Or, if not, perhaps it's subtractive. Perhaps it's a simple issue. That'll be up for you to decide. Thanks, guys. I hope you guys all enjoyed this podcast today, and I hope you all have a fantastic day, weekend, or holiday. See you.
See you guys. Gracias a todos.